Hello and welcome to our Office 365 Summit. My name is Brian Nice, and I'm going to be covering the Server Core and Voice Improvements module for you. I work for Microsoft Consulting Services as a Unified Communications Architect, and my goal here is to take you through two specific areas with regards to Skype for Business Server, the first of which being the area of Core Server and the improvements that we've made in the Core Server, and the second area being our voice improvements. So looking on the left, when we talk through our core server improvements, we're really going to focus in on four specific areas. How we've improved the reliability of chat and presence, talk a little bit about our mobility improvements, give you a brief overview of what we've changed from a conferencing reliability perspective, and finally we'll talk a little bit about our manageability improvements. From there, we'll shift into our discussion about voice. And we'll cover off a couple of interesting topics for us related to voice, one of which being a feature that some of you may recognize from previous iterations of our product called Call Via Work. Let's talk a little bit about how that solution works. We'll talk about the improvements we've made with scalability for the response group service. We'll talk a little bit about our friend Silk and what that means in our Skype for Business client. And we'll round things out with a quick overview of our call quality dashboard. So let's dive right in. I'm going to start by talking about our core server improvements. And as we mentioned, there's four specific areas that we want to focus in on. And in order to be able to dig through areas like chat, presence, mobility, conferencing, and so forth, we kind of want to set the stage and make sure we're on the same page with understanding what the core server really is. So when you look at this particular slide, looking at this slide from the ground up, you can see that we have the definition of what is the core server. And our core server really covers the authentication components, signaling routing, security aspects, storage, compliance. These are all areas that we are heavily leveraging and utilizing in our core server component. And we expose a lot of these components through these various platforms that you see in the middle, such as UCWA, UCMA, UCAP, UCJ, things of that nature, that we can use to help build and develop not only our clients, but also the extensibility into the platform, creating our art of the possible with our platform for Skype for Business Services. On top of that platform, you can see apps that would consume these types of services, most notably, of course, being chat and presence, which we're going to start our discussion, but also things like voice and conferencing. These are all various upper layer applications that can leverage the stack that you're seeing here from a platform and all the way down into the core server perspective. So first area that we want to get into is to discuss a little bit about chat and presence and how we've improved reliability of chat and presence. So one of the first items that we talk through with chat and presence reliability has to do with optimization of the sign-in traffic and presence itself. And what we've seen in initial testing is a reduction of about 25% for the traffic that we're seeing from a chat and a presence perspective. So why is this important? You know, a lot of times we look at chat and we look at presence and we think, it's not really that big of a deal. It's just, what color is my jelly bean? Am I there? Am I not? Am I available? Can I IM you or not? But if you think about this in the context of people becoming more mobile, right? Folks are continuously moving from one place to another. We're sometimes wired at home. We're sometimes wireless. Sometimes we're on 4G or LTE. Sometimes we go back to Wi-Fi. And we have to be able to deal with the fact that as my client is moving across these various connectivity types, there's all different types of sign-ins and presence changes that are happening on the back end. So we wanted to be able to optimize the client itself, Skype for Business, to be able to reduce that presence and sign-in traffic, while in turn also caching data so that we don't have to do a complete refresh of data every single time we sign in. That's where a lot of this reduction can come from, by being able to cache a lot of this on the client side. Otherwise, if we didn't cache this data, every time our client changed connectivity methods or had to sign out and sign back in, we'd have to go through this laborious process of being able to pull this data down again, and it would be relatively inefficient. So number one, we've optimized this presence and sign-in traffic by being able to cache some of this data in the client side. This in turn is going to help us reduce the re-sign-in traffic so that we get better utilization out of the client itself, depending on, you know, whatever type of connectivity method we're using. Now, in addition to the performance aspects, we also want to be able to get better telemetry and better monitoring out of our Skype for Business clients. And there are a number of ways that we've helped to improve the telemetry side of things. Most of the time, you would expect to see these types of changes in things like CDR data or perfmon counters and so forth. And absolutely, we have provided mechanisms in that fashion as well. Right, but also being able to expose additional telemetry items out into the client and being able to give me feedback on what your call quality experience was like. Was that a decent call? Was that not a decent call? And so forth. So getting more exposure into not only the raw nuts and bolts of data that ends up in CDR and QoE, but also being able to correlate that telemetry with actual user feedback. And finally, we've definitely put a lot of attention into the mobile experience. The mobile experience in and of itself is a very challenging experience because you are on a device that's a smaller form factor. You are constantly changing connectivity methods, whether you're on Wi-Fi or wireless and so forth, Wi-Fi or LTE or 4G and so forth. So we wanted to be able to provide a better user experience across mobile. And as you'll see in the coming slides, we've certainly done a number of improvements in the mobile area that can help address and provide a much better mobile experience across the board. Speaking of mobile, the improvements that we've made in mobility, they extend beyond the typical improvements that you may expect from a mobile perspective. You know, can I get better battery life and so on and so forth? To really show off what we've done, let's kind of put this into a problem solution scenario, right? So these are, from a mobility standpoint, some of the key problems that we've seen with regards to the user experience. The first and probably one of the more painful ones has been trying to send an IM to a user. The user happens to be on mobile, and we get what I typically refer to as the donut of patience. Right, the little spinning donut that just sits there and it just tests your resolve and patience to see how long you're actually going to wait for that thing to go. And of course, waiting for the mobile user to accept it. Now, the user on the other end, perhaps they've gotten a toast for the message. Maybe they didn't. Maybe it disappeared. And we're basically stuck in this limbo world of I've got the little spinning donut and this little donut of patience, and I have no idea whether the user actually received the message or not. So one of the ways that we've addressed that from a mobility perspective is to provide an auto-accept mechanism. Right, so the same logic that the desktop client will use to accept an IM based on your best available or most recently active endpoint. Right, so ensuring that we can get an accept message on that message that's been sent out from a particular end user. In turn, a lot of times we may see an incoming IM on mobile just disappear. It's come in and you saw a toast for it, and then you go back to find that particular IM and it's gone. It's not there. We go into our mobile client and I don't have any indication of the IM that was sent in. Or perhaps I see the initial invite to it and then I can't continue that particular conversation. So again, we've worked around that by using this auto accept mechanism and ensuring that at least one of these best available endpoints can actually accept this incoming IM and get the conversation moving. Now, that's really just part of the puzzle, right? Because it's great that the initial conversation gets accepted. So perhaps I've just gone mobile, right? And I've left my home office where I have my desktop Skype for Business client running, and I've just gone mobile, and a notification comes in. Perhaps it gets auto-accepted by my desktop client, but now I'm mobile, and I'd really like to continue that IM conversation on my mobile device. Well, that was a problem for us in the traditional sense with previous iterations of mobile because we didn't have a full history of IM conversations. The mobile device only showed us the conversation history of conversations that happened on mobile. So if something was accepted on my desktop, I didn't know about that conversation. I couldn't easily pick that conversation up on my mobile. We've worked around that by providing the solution in the form of server-side or server-based conversation history across all of our endpoints. So now, regardless of whether I'm on mobile, desktop, web, what have you, I have the capability to pick that conversation up and run with it. So I can start the conversation on my desktop. I can now go mobile, look into my mobile client, and I can see that same conversation is there. I can pick it up and continue having that same conversation now that I'm on my mobile device. You know, lastly, a very strong pain point for us in the world of mobility was single sign-on capability when it came to Exchange and Skype for Business. Right, we had mechanisms that we could put into play in Link 2013, such as passive authentication, where we could do two-factor-based or multi-factor-based authentication, but that always left Exchange kind of in a lurch. We had no mechanism to be able to provide the multi-factor authentication to the Exchange pieces, so now suddenly you would be in a situation where you turn on multi-factor auth for mobile, but now you have to turn off the Exchange integration features, and the user doesn't see their calendar now, and it became a disjointed experience. And we didn't want to have that experience from a mobile perspective. So we're looking to address the single sign-on and multi-factor aspect by adopting a technology called ADL, or Azure Active Directory Authentication Library. So what's that? ADL is based on the OAuth protocol, and anyone that's familiar with Link Server 2013 will be familiar with the concept of OAuth, or a mechanism that we use, a protocol that we use for server-to-server-based authentication. Well, Azure AD Authentication Library is built on top of the OAuth 2.0 protocol, and what it does is provide a uniform mechanism to provide this passive authentication concept across our Office 365 applications to give us single sign-on. So think about it in the context of Link Server 2013. If you were familiar with passive authentication, we instituted that as a way to provide two-factor authentication, but it was only focused on Link. Right? We couldn't utilize that passive authentication with Exchange or with SharePoint or what have you. The solution to that is ADL. Because this now pulls that passive authentication concept up a layer, and it's not just down at the link layer, but it's now uniform across the O365 application environment. So this will replace passive auth in Link Server 2013 and gives us this flexibility now to provide multi-factor auth not just for Link, but also for Exchange components as well. This is also much more flexible in the sense that we can enable this on an as-needed type basis. So for example, hey, I'm in the office, I'm using my desktop client to sign in with my normal credentials, use Kerberos, life is good, but I'm using my mobile client. Well, I want that to be two-factor auth. I don't want to have to do necessarily two-factor auth on my desktop, I just want to do it on mobile. Well, with ADL, we can enable that just for my mobile clients. Another improvement from our 2013 days, where effectively if we turned on passive auth, it was at the pool level, and you didn't have a very clean way to turn this on just for mobile clients. This, of course, will then provide us this wide range of multi-factor authentication options for us. Of course, there are some requirements that we have. Our Server 2012 R2 web application proxy is needed if we want to be able to distinguish an inside client or an internal client from an external client. So again, imagine the situation where you're on mobile or you're even on your desktop and you're inside the network, go ahead and use Kerberos. But once you go outside the network, go ahead and use two-factor auth, right? So ADL is going to expand our capability of being able to provide more granular control over how we perform the authentication process based on where the user is located, whether it's geography or whether it's internal inside the network or outside your network. Another key component that we had with regards to mobile has to do with our server-side conversation history, right? And this is a key experience for us to be able to have that uniform experience when you blend across your desktop and your mobile type environments. It captures our successful calls, our missed calls, our chat history, exactly what you would expect, the same type of data that you would see in your conversation history folder inside of Exchange. The architecture itself leverages USIWA, right? The UC Web API. That's the mechanism that we're going to use as our entry point through the front ends to be able to gain access to the link storage APIs, or lists as we call it, which in turn can then write this information into Exchange. You are not required to do any type of new server or new role deployment or any of that nature. This is just simply integrated into the front-end servers themselves via the UCWA mechanisms. And of course, we will have the ability to control and configure this through policy, in-band policy through mobile and desktop as well, giving us the flexibility to be able to decide what we capture from a server-side conversation history perspective. The fun thing about the entry point here being USIWA is, you know, we do mention in the architecture that we're leveraging USIWA for these mobile clients. Basically, when the feature gets turned on for desktop clients, the consumer of USIWA becomes the desktop client as well. So this USIWA is really the entry point that we have for server-side conversation history, whether you're on desktop or whether you're on mobile. And that's a key differentiator because now it gives us that flexibility to be able to treat these endpoints the same from a server-side conversation history perspective, even though one is on the mobile side of things and one happens to be on the desktop side of things. So definitely a marked improvement for us to be able to push conversation history to all of our various endpoints. Moving from mobility into conferencing, there were certainly some challenges that we had in the Link 2013 space when it came to conferencing reliability. And most often it was related in one form or another to architectural changes that we made in the 2013 platform. And as some of you may be familiar with, the most common change that we talk about from an architectural perspective in Link 2013 was the addition of the Windows Fabric component, and effectively the decoupling of our backend SQL instance into more of a lazy write mechanism, where changes would be written to the front ends, and then we would utilize this lazy write mechanism to synchronize the changes to the blob store, as we called it, or the backend SQL database. And while this certainly helped improve performance and so forth, there was a bit of a trade-off with that asynchronous write mechanism when it came to conference state. And we could end up in a situation where we would have corruption of conference data, data that was lost in regards to the creation of a new conference or a new meeting. So what we've done in Skype for Business Server is adapted this model to perform synchronous writes to the backend database for our conference state. So rather than relying on the asynchronous model of front ends lazy writing their changes to the backends, it became, let's write this synchronously to the front end and the back end for conference state at the same time. In addition, let's not just look at it from a single pool perspective, but let's talk about what happens when you pair these pools together. So in addition to providing these synchronous writes to the back end for conference state, we're also now prioritizing replication of the conference state between pools when we do the backup service, when we do replication between paired pools. Again, this just helps to give us better reliability from a conferencing perspective because we have much more consistent state of data, both on the primary pool as well as the backup pool. This in turn all helps us to improve the data loss protection with the conference directory data itself, right? And not ending up in situations where a user tries to dial into a conference and the meeting ID is not found, or they can't pin off into the conference or something to that effect. We also needed to introduce better handling of how we expire conferences. You know, a lot of telemetry that we had seen in the environment was based on the fact that folks were attempting to join meetings that simply didn't exist anymore, meetings that were already expired meetings. And a lot of times that can happen when users are inadvertently creating new meetings. And they go into their Outlook client, they create a new meeting, they create an ad hoc meeting URL, and maybe they just copy and paste that URL and send it on its merry way through email. Or they make some changes to the meeting and then they close it and don't save it, but then send that same URL out again. Perhaps they take a URL from one appointment and copy and paste it into another appointment. And all of these mechanisms cause situations where a meeting invite may go out for a meeting that is no longer valid. It's been expired from that perspective. So we've helped to adapt that by increasing the amount of time it takes for these conferences to expire, helping us to mitigate that in the short term. Clearly, it's better to mitigate in the long term from a user education perspective and ensure that we're not getting ourselves into a situation where we're sending out expired meeting content. But in the short term, increasing the time it takes to expire these meetings helps to resolve a lot of these situations and giving us this better handling of these expired conferences. And of course, at the end of the day, we also want to be able to have better telemetry from a conferencing perspective. So we have some additional CDR data that's collected, some additional performance monitor counters that have been instituted that can also help us understand what's going on from a conferencing perspective and how are we behaving under our meeting join conditions and so forth. And all of that telemetry is going to help us get a much more reliable experience from a conferencing perspective. Now, when we look at manageability, this is another area of improvement based on some changes that we initially instituted in the Link Server 2013 space. And again, as I mentioned previously, one of the most sought-after changes that we had made from a core perspective on Link Server 2013 had to do with Windows Fabric. And one of the ways that we've helped to improve manageability in Skype for Business Server was to take the existing iteration of Windows Fabric and provide an upgrade to that. And that's exactly what we've done here with Skype for Business Server. We are still utilizing Windows Fabric. We are now utilizing Windows Fabric V2. Previously in Server 2013, we used V1, Windows Fabric. V2 provides us with a much more robust set of APIs to assist us in things such as failover management. So for example, here we mentioned that there's a new API called the Deactivate API. And what that helps us to achieve is now when I'm doing management of a pool, say for example, patching, I can leverage these APIs to safely deactivate a server from the Fabric ring and then proceed to stop the Link services or the Skype for Business Server services and provide patching in a much more controlled way, right? Eliminating the challenges that we had seen previously from a patching perspective where we may have multiple servers down or multiple upgrade domains down. You know, these new APIs can help us to better manage the entire failover process within a pool so that we can more efficiently patch and manage the pool in and of itself. V2 also provides us with the same items that we had seen before in V1, where we had primary and secondary node election, the replication between these nodes, and so forth. But a lot of these changes come with better intelligence on the back end. So as we start running various commandlets, checking to ensure that we have appropriate replicas established, that we have stability of the replicas across the pool and so forth. So all of this, all of these advantages are brought to light by version 2 of the Windows Fabric component. Because we have this new V2 component, in addition to things such as failover management, which give us this better API, we've also instituted a new mechanism that we can use to actually start up a pool. And you can see here on this slide that we reference the start CS pool commandlet. And this is a new commandlet that we can use to help with the cold start of a pool. So imagine a situation where you've just deployed a brand new Skype for Business Server pool, or perhaps you've done an upgrade from Link Server 2013 in place to Skype for Business Server. And maybe you have 12 front-end servers in this particular pool. How do you start all of those services? Understanding that they need to be started at the same time. They need to be a certain number of servers. You know, there's a laundry list of all these different checks and balances that you have to kind of go through in your mind to ensure that you don't get yourself in a state where the pool gets stuck in a starting state, or perhaps doesn't start at all. Well, we provided the start CS pool commandlet to give you some additional guidance, feedback, and intelligence into this process. So rather than having to go to each front-end server and do a start CS window service or do start CS window service dash computer name, what have you, instead of that, just simply run start CS pool. This will go through a series of steps, as you can see outlined here. First off being, do we have the prerequisites that we need? In other words, the pool that we're targeting, is it a Skype for Business Server pool? Is it running Windows Fabric V2? This commandlet is specifically for Skype for Business Server pools, so can't run it against your 2013, 2010 pools. So we do our prereq checks. We try to start up the services, start up all the servers and services in the pool. And now we start looking to see if we've got any problems on any of these servers. If we do, as we're looking through these extended diagnostics, encounter a type of problem, provide an alert through the PowerShell command itself. So give you some visible feedback. Perhaps we can't start a front end, right? Maybe you've looked at it and said, well, yeah, I know I can't start front end number 4 because he's powered off and they're working on it. There's a hardware problem. I can't start it. No worries. We can use an exclusion list, a skip server parameter for start CS pool to tell it to start the pool but skip this one particular server. But we're going to build intelligence into that command. So again, if you, for example, have a 12 front-end server pool and you decide to run start CS pool and you exclude 8 of the servers, well, you only have 4 servers left. That's not enough from a minimum server perspective. The cool thing is, in the Link 2013 world, we had to go back to our TechNet documentation and how many servers do I need, and it's 85% of this, and I just want these things to start. Well, we'll go ahead and build that intelligence into this commandlet. If we don't have the minimum server requirements that are necessary, we'll feed that back to you as part of the start CS pool commandlet. So now we get these server services coming up. Now we're starting to hydrate these routing groups. Uh-oh, what if a routing group can't come online? Perhaps it's going to require quorum loss recovery. Well, in the 2013 days, that was a challenge. We had to run our reset CS pool registrar state with quorum loss recovery. And what does that really do? And how does that start CS pool can build some of that intelligence in there for you. I'm going to start seeding these routing groups. Hey, this is going to cause quorum loss recovery to be run. Well, let me check and see if any data would be lost by doing quorum loss recovery. If there isn't any data loss that would happen, this commandlet will just simply invoke quorum loss recovery for you and reseed the routing group replica sets as appropriate. If there is a possibility that there will be data loss by running this quorum loss recovery, well, now we're going to bubble that up to the IT administrator, to the link administrator in this commandlet and say, oh, hey, I see quorum loss recovery. We may lose some data here. Do you want to continue and go ahead and let me run this and perhaps have some data loss? Or do you want to skip it? And you can choose to skip that particular routing group replica and move on, allowing you to at least get the pool up and running for the 98% of the user population that is not having a problem. And then you can go and spend your own time working internally or with Premier or what have you to dig into why that other routing group replica or set of replicas won't start. Right? So it's no longer an all or nothing issue when it comes to routing group placement. We now have this option to be able to skip some specific replicas and get as much of the pool online as possible. Of course, after all these checks and balances complete, we'll go ahead and start up all the servers and services if we don't encounter any other issues. So that is one of the major advantages of some of these APIs that we've exposed from Windows Fabric 2.0. But another advantage that we've introduced is the ability to have a much more simplified patching process. Right? So you can see on the left there, it's quite the eye chart for all the various steps that we need to do just to be able to figure out how we're going to patch this particular system. And then we hope that we didn't take down more than one upgrade domain, or maybe I don't know what an upgrade domain is, and it just became a bit of a nightmare to try and go through this patching methodology. You can see on the right how we've streamlined that with the help of these APIs that we have in Windows Fabric. Now it's a simple two sets of commands. Invoke CSComputer failover, invoke CSComputer fail back, right? Those commandlets are going to leverage these APIs that we have inside of Windows Fabric 2.0 to be able to deactivate the system properly from the Fabric ring, to be able to stop the Windows, the Skype for Business services gracefully, allowing you to confidently bring that server out of service, patch it, do whatever you need to do with that particular system, and then when you're ready, provide this invoke CSComputer fail back, which will restart the Skype for Business server services and place this particular node back into the activate state in the Fabric ring and start placing routing groups and router group replicas onto that system. And then you just continue on for the next set of servers and makes this patching process a much more straightforward process with a lot of safety checks built in. Lastly, in the manageability arena, we have this concept of a health readiness check, which is effectively the online equivalent of what we would call the best practice analyzer. So you will be able to go through Skype for Business Online admin page. You'll be able to see the health readiness check there, and it can basically go through on a server-by-server basis and provide a health readiness report for your particular systems that you run the health check against. Okay, let's take a direction change here and talk a little bit about our voice improvements. So when we look at voice improvements, we have four areas of focus when it comes to voice. There's the call via work mechanism, response group scalability, our friend Silk in Skype for Business, and the call quality dashboard. So let's start with call via work. And the best way to really envision how a call via work functions is to take a little jog down memory lane. And one of the first areas that we run into is our friend Remote Call Control, also called RCC. This was a feature that we had made available way back in the LCS days. So in Live Communication Server 2005 SP1, we introduced this concept called Remote Call Control. And essentially, it's the ability for you to utilize your client, your link client, for example, to send commands to a PBX phone and control it, make it go off hook, make it dial numbers, and so forth. That was really the extent of what RCC was, right? It's only supported in this case with Link Server and the Link Desktop Client because that was the latest release that we actually had deployed support for remote call control. Not much has been done with the RCC spec from anybody's perspective, the PBX vendors, ours, whatnot. So RCC itself is deprecated with the Skype for Business client. So while it's still supported in the currently released products, the recommendation is to switch to utilizing Enterprise Voice. And if you still have a need for these types of feature sets, then you should investigate the call via work aspect. And that's what we're going to do next. So what's call via work? It's actually a feature that it's not entirely brand new to the Link or the Skype for Business server world. It's a feature that we had way back in the Link days where you actually had this call via work mechanism for mobile, right? Where I could join a meeting and then have it call me in that fashion, or I could make an outbound call and have it bridge in my cell phone, something to that effect. So it's not an entirely new concept, but it is a little bit different in how we approach it with customers today. So let's look at what it is and how it works. So call via work. First off, it's an enterprise voice solution allowing users to make voice calls using any phone, PSTN phone. Now, remember, in the Link world, when we say PSTN, it doesn't necessarily have to be something that's actually hanging off the PSTN. Basically, in the Link world or the Skype for Business world, when we say PSTN, it's anything outside of Link. So that could be an existing PBX endpoint. It could be a mobile phone, something to that effect. But we can use any of those endpoints to make a call. It leverages direct SIP connectivity between the legacy PBX system and us, Skype for Business. And the way the user experience works is when I want to utilize Call via Work, Skype for Business will dial out to the external entity, the PSTN entity, the desk phone, what have you, connect that endpoint, and then connect to the far end endpoint and merge those calls together. And we'll see a graphical representation of this coming up. This does provide us presence updates and call control from our Skype for Business client, because as I make that outbound call for my Skype for Business client, my presence can be updated to in a call. If we want to utilize mid-call control, we have the capability of doing the mid-call control components through our PBX phones. So if I want to place the call on hold, and then all of those features and functions will still continue to work through the PBX phone itself. So let's take a little look at the flow here. And here you can see what the actual Call via Work call flow will look like. So first, I have my user sitting here on their Skype for Business client, right? So I instantiate my call for my Skype for Business rich client. That is going to then invoke, from the server's perspective, a call to the PBX station, right? So that's the desk phone that I want to, quote, control, if you will. So that's the blue line that you see here, right? PBX routes the call, and your desk phone answers. When I see, from a client perspective, that this call has been answered at the PBX station, now I'm going to make the far end call, which is what you see here, 456 to this destination, right? PBX call, of course, or the PBX is then going to route this call out to the PSTN. In this case, maybe I'm dialing the local pizza shop down the street, perhaps I'm dialing a mobile phone, but the call is now being made as another outbound call. Once this is answered and established, the control plane is still here between my Skype for Business client, the PBX, the PSTN, and so forth. But of course, the audio is going from this PBX station to this destination, right? So my Skype for Business client is not actually in the audio path. My Skype for Business client is in the call control or the signaling path. Now, that's an outbound experience. What happens when a call comes inbound? Well, there isn't an experience for inbound for Call via Work, right? Inbound would be handled by how your infrastructure is set up, right? So is the call hitting the PBX first? Is it doing a SIM ring, or does it hit Skype for Business first? Does it do a SIM ring and so forth? Call via Work itself is not involved in the inbound aspect, right? We still can do the same traditional items that we had done previously. As is today, Call via Work is not available in the cloud. So something to be thinking about from a planning perspective, if you're looking to migrate users into the cloud and you want to continue to leverage Call via Work, at this time, Call via Work is not available in the cloud. Okay, a little bit deeper on the call flow side. We start looking at the detailed steps here, right? So again, we have user A. User A is deciding that they're going to initiate a call out to the PSTNs. In this case, perhaps they're calling somebody's mobile phone. Right, so if the call is initiated from the Skype for Business client that you see here, that call flow, much like we saw previously, the call request is going to go to USIWA. USIWA is going to make the outbound call, right, establishing to this desk phone, and then also establishing this call here, right, as we had seen earlier. And because this call was initiated by the Skype for Business client, we're going to get the little conversation window that pops up. Right, my presence is going to change. I'll see the little conversation window, and if I want to hang up the call, I can click the little hang up button, and life is good. Right, that's the simplest outbound call flow that we're going to see. Now, if the user happens to pick up their desk phone here and make an outbound call, of course, now Skype for Business has no knowledge of that outbound call. So that's why we say here the conversation window will not be available. And that's because if the user just simply picks up their desk phone and makes an outbound call, we as a client don't have any knowledge of that. So no presence update is going to happen at that point, and no conversation window is going to be available. Now, let's take this a step further. What if I'm going to make a call, but I'm calling another internal user, right? So I am Skype for Business user A, and I'm calling user B, who also is on our internal network. What happens in that case, right? So again, same flow that we saw before. Let's look at it from the Skype for Business side of things. So here's Skype for Business user A. I'm making a call to user B. So I place the call. Of course, we route the call over to the PBX, which rings desk phone user A, because that's mine, right? I've got to be able to ring my own desk phone. That's the first leg of the call. Once that's answered, now UCWA says, okay, now I've got to join the second leg of the call. So I'm going to call Skype for Business user B. Now check this out. I am calling Skype for Business user B. In this case, I'm just doing a regular old Skype call, right? So that's going to be a SIP call that goes to this Skype for Business user B. Well, this user is enabled for call via work. And call via work is also leveraging or can also respect SimRing settings. So we see this call come in to Skype for Business user B. They have SimRing set to their desk phone. So because SimRing is set for their desk phone, we're going to go ahead and send another call out, because it's a SimRing, to ring their handset, their desk phone handset. Now, we mention over here that we use something called the MS-SKIP RNL header. Essentially, what we're doing here is we are helping to bypass the reverse number lookup mechanism. Right? Because if I have a situation, as you're going to see in later slides here, my Skype for Business user B, his DID that's configured, or his phone number, is going to be the same phone number configured in Link, because he's Enterprise Voice, Skype for Business, because he's Enterprise Voice. It's going to be the same phone number that's over here on the PBX. Well, as you guys know, if I call that phone number directly, reverse number lookup is going to check that and go, oh, no, no, that's Skype for Business user B. And it's going to simply send it to his Skype endpoint, and that's the end of it. Well, because we use this skip RNL header, that tells us, go ahead and call that number, but don't RNL it. And that's what causes the call to go here to this PBX and then ring desk phone user B. Now the user has a choice. They can answer it here on their Skype for Business client, or they can answer it here on their desk phone. And if they answer it on their desk phone, right, our audio stream is going desk phone to desk phone. If they answer it here, our audio stream is going desk phone user A to Skype for Business user B, right? Again, this guy here, Skype for Business user A, no audio, no media going to him. He's just in the control plane, right? But all of the media is happening between this desk phone and whichever endpoint user B decided to answer. As we mentioned, if we initiate it from the Skype for Business client, you get the conversation window. If you initiate it from the desk phone, you don't. Pretty straightforward. So what about that situation that we just talked through, where all of a sudden I'm calling another user that has a SimRing set? Well, as we mentioned, when we deliver the inbound call to the Skype for Business client, it is possible to SimRing the user's PBX phone at the same time. Now, this will not only happen in calls that are coming from the PSTM, but this would also happen from other internal calls, as we saw in the previous slide, from our Skype for Business users. So the forward and SimRing settings get tied with the activation of the call via work feature. So if you are using call via work to make an outbound call, any inbound call that you get will automatically be configured to SimRing or forward to your PBX phone. Now again, that presents a challenge when you start looking at the DID configuration or the phone number configuration, because in call via work, the user's phone number in Skype for Business and the user's phone number on the PBX will be the same. And if we don't utilize this MS-SKIP RNL header, when the call comes to Skype for Business server and we try to send that on to the PBX, it'll never make it, because we'll look at the number and go, oh, that number's tied to this user in Skype for Business server. Just send it via SIP and we're done. Well, that's not the desired effect. We want it to end up on the PBX phone. Hence, we'll, under the covers, use this MS-SKIP RNL header. This is something that's automatically instituted by the client. You don't have to configure anything to make the SKIP RNL header work or anything of that nature. This is all built into the intelligence of call via work. So let's look at what that looks like. All right, again, here we go with an inbound call from another internal user. So here's Skype for Business user A. Here's Skype for Business user B. So in this instance, I have user B here on the right. He's going to make a call to user A. Let's assume that he uses his client, his Skype for Business client. So this is just my Skype for Business client calling another Skype for Business client. When that call comes in, we have to figure out who originated the call, and that's what this chart is showing here, right? Did the call come from Skype for Business, or did the call come from the user's desk phone, right? If the call came from Skype for Business, we alert their endpoint. You get a toast. Hello. And since he's enabled for call via work, we also simring with Skip RNL his desk phone so that this can ring, right? So that first flow from the call, the client itself, you can see figure one here, Skype for Business calls this Skype for Business user, and then simring says, oh, you need to ring this, Skip RNL, because otherwise it would just go right back to here. Skip RNL, go ahead and ring the PBX and get that user's desk phone to ring. And then again, depending on which endpoint they answer from, the media will flow from my Skype for Business client to his Skype for Business client if he answered it there, or to this desk phone if he answered it here. If you just do it from the desk phone, right? Desk phone calling desk phone, nothing's happening, right? These guys just call each other because there's no intelligence when that call goes from the user's desk phone, PBX, to the desk phone. The Skype for Business client is not in the loop at all. So as you can see, when we do it from the PBX phone, right, there's no toast that shows up. There's no missed call notification. Yes, we would end up in voicemail based on how the PBX is configured, but we wouldn't get these additional mechanisms that we get if we use the Skype for Business client as the initiator of the call. Coming from the PSTN works much the same way, right? I have a PSTN user here on their mobile. They call user A. This is going to be dependent on who's first in line, right? In figure one, Skype for Business servers first in line. So let's look at that. Call comes in from mobile, hits Skype for Business server, which does an RNL on the number and says, oh yeah, that's user A, and sends a SIP message to user A to notify their Skype for Business client, and they get a toast. User is configured for call via work, which configures SimRing, which sends the call with Skip RNL and rings the user's desk phone, right? And as we mentioned, depending on what you answer, which endpoint you answer with, media will flow to this endpoint if they answer on Skype, or this endpoint if they answer on their desk phone. Alternatively, if we take that same scenario, but we don't put Skype for Business in line first, but we put the PBX in line, well, now you're dependent on the PBX config. And out of the gate, this call is going to hit the PBX and ring their desk phone, and that's all we're going to get, right? If there's no SIM ring or anything like that configured here, Skype for Business user A has no clue that this call has come in. So as mentioned down here, no toast, no unanswered, no missed call notification, but yes, you could still end up in voicemail based on the PBX config. Lastly, we provide you with this mechanism to show what the meeting join scenarios would look like. Won't take the time to go through every single scenario here, but you can see when we're going to join a meeting, is it going to be an outbound join? Is it going to be an inbound join? And whether we actually get presence changed or not. And much the same as we had talked about before, if a lot of these are initiated from the Skype for Business client, then we'll be able to get that rich experience of having the conversation window, having our presence updated, and so forth. But if I take a scenario like here, this bottom one, I just dial into the bridge from my desk phone, well, then Skype for Business has no knowledge of you making that call. So I don't get a conversation window. My presence will show as whatever my presence is. It doesn't get dynamically updated. So it could be available or busy or, you know, whatever your presence is, but it does not change to in a call or in a conference call. And same thing is true, you know, when we start looking at inbound join, right? If you get added by name, what happens when we, you know, click that toast? Well, then we're going to reach out to your desk phone. Which is advantageous, right? Somebody adds you into meeting, you get a toast on the Skype for Business client. We don't immediately ring your desk phone. We pop the toast, and if you decide that you want to join the meeting, then we go ahead and ring your desk phone. Obviously, if we call you by number and we have SIM ring set, then we're going to get that same type of call that we see here, but it's going to come via the Skype for Business client. All of these pieces are controlled through policy And this configuration will in fact be roamed successfully between your MPOP endpoints. So that way, if you move from machine to machine or system to system, these settings will follow you. And you can see it's simple settings like call via work enabled. Right? Do we have a Boolean option as to whether this is turned on or off? We can forcibly set the admin callback number and use admin callback number. These being the E164 defined phone numbers that would be used as the callback number. And then there's a Boolean, this use admin callback number, as to whether you force that or whether you simply set it and then let the user change that option if they so desire. By default, the admin callback number is typically going to be their defined number. But you do have the option to override that if you want to make it a generic number or a main office line or something to that effect. When you enable the user for call via work, you'll actually see a change in the client under the call handling options, where you can see here you're very familiar with the top box of incoming calls and simultaneous ring and so forth, but then you'll also see this new outgoing calls section. And this is where we can define, hey, for the outgoing calls, what is the number that I'm going to use, which, again, you can see in the screenshot, it's actually mapped to the user's phone number, which is the same as what you see for SimRing, which is what would you ring the user's actual desk phone with the skip RNL parameter. And in this case, we've not forced this on the user, so they could change this if they so desire, or you can utilize the admin interface to fix this to be the user's actual DID. Okay, let's talk about our improvements to the response group service. One of the areas that we were working through with response group service always had to do with scalability, and one of the major enhancements that we've made with RGS is to effectively double the scalability for RGS and Skype for Business Server. So our agent group number is 800 now, the IVRs are 400, and up to 2,400 agents per pool. And those numbers are effectively doubled from the scalability numbers that we had in Link Server 2013. As noted, these are the numbers as of today. There is still some additional RTM testing that's being done, so these numbers will be finalized once we complete our RTM testing. So definitely check back with our documentation on TechNet to get our final numbers. Now, another area of improvement we had with regards to voice centers around the codec that we've decided to use in Skype for Business. And anyone familiar with the consumer version of Skype will likely have heard of the Silk codec. This particular codec has made its way into the Skype for Business client as well. And as you can see on this slide, we will be utilizing Silk as our default codec for all of our Skype for Business peer-to-peer sessions, all of our Skype peer-to-peer sessions. So when we're doing federation between a Skype for Business client and a Skype client peer-to-peer, we'll be using the Silk codec here as well. Silk was actually introduced in one of the cumulative updates for the Link 2013 desktop client, and it is available for mobile peer-to-peer calls. But in Link 2013, we still utilize RTA as our default codec, or real-time audio. That codec will still be there in Skype for Business. It's necessary for backwards compatibility. Silk is also not supported on a single core CPU system. So when we start looking at clients that are going to have support for Silk, right, you notice here that our Link desktop client, our Skype for Business desktop client, the Link web app, all of our mobile endpoints, those are all going to have support for Silk. However, the VDI plugin, the Link web app, the attendant, the phone edition, those are not going to have support for Silk. Incidentally, when I look at the supported clients, the Link app there is the Windows Store app, not the Link web app. That is the Link Windows Store app that is a supported client. The final area of improvement for voice centers around a component that we are calling the call quality dashboard. And again, to kind of understand and appreciate the call quality dashboard, we want to take a little look at the history and the journey that we've gone through to identify call quality. Initially, when we had Link Server 2013, we introduced the Link 2013 networking guide. And this was a very comprehensive guide, 150 or so pages, that included a whole bunch of sample SQL queries that you could use to start extracting call quality information from your CDR and QoE databases. We use that as a foundation to then build on to what we call the call quality methodology, or CQM. And effectively what we did here was start to take a lot of the more common aspects, the SQL queries that we had before, and really start to focus them into about a set of 30 or so SQL queries, a series of PowerShell commands, and culminate all of this into a scorecard or an Excel workbook, with the intent of being able to give you visibility into call quality in your environment and breaking that visibility down into manageable chunks. You know, where am I seeing these call quality issues? Are they arising between components such as the servers and the mediation server, the AVMCU and the mediation server and the gateway, the end user, the last mile? Are they on wired? Are they on wireless, right? And giving you focus areas to start pinpointing segments of your internal environment or external environment that could be experiencing call quality issues, and then using that methodology to start refining and attacking areas where we're seeing poor call quality to get improvements. The natural genesis from that is what we now call the call quality dashboard. And the call quality dashboard is essentially what we've learned from call quality methodology, but also taking the data that we found inside of QoE and consolidating this into an analysis cube, and then exposing this analysis cube through a series of APIs and report portals, which we'll get into in the next couple of slides here. So the major features of the call quality dashboard include the fact that it is QoE data. This is not new data that we're instituting for Skype for Business Server. This is our QoE archive. So it's essentially the same data that you have in the quality of experience databases. The difference is we're actually extracting this data and putting it into SQL Server Analysis Services as a cube, and then instituting reports against that cube that we've established. This results, number one, in some very impressive query return performance gains, because we're less than 1 second querying against these cubes because the data is optimized to be reported against. It's also now pulling that information away from your day-to-day, you know, QoE database, where you may only have, you know, 60 days worth of data before you extrapolate that data out. We can now pull that into this archive of CQD, and now we can start generating reports that allow us to see trending and analysis data. So perhaps I can see over the last 3 months that my call quality was improving, and then suddenly it got worse. And maybe I can go back and tie that to an event that happened. Perhaps we put some new gear in, and we had some problems with change management, and an old config was applied, and something got messed up. And, you know, we start to now identify trends as to how things are performing, and whether they were better than they previously were, or whether that performance is declining. This gets exposed via a web API as well as an HTML5 JavaScript report portal. There'll be lots of ways to edit and design various reports, and it will come as an add-on or a web download for Skype for Business Server, shipping about the same time. And here you can see just a rough example of a prototype of what some of the reportings are going to look like. So this happens to be showing the managed and unmanaged audio streams and the graphs that you can see from inside of here. A lot of customization will become available for us to be able to drill down and see exactly what's going on from a call quality perspective. So in summary, we talked about two major areas, the core server improvements and the voice improvements. And when we focused on core server, we were really looking at four areas inside of core server improvements: our chat and presence reliability, and being able to get a good reduction of the traffic that we used for chat and presence. We talked about our mobility improvements with our introduction to server-side conversation history, among others. Our conferencing reliability to help us to ensure that we have a better experience from a conferencing perspective, and our manageability improvements around the introduction of Windows Fabric 2.0. In our voice improvements, we talked about our call via work aspects, which can help us leverage our enterprise voice solutions in conjunction with our existing legacy PBX phones. We talked about our scalability numbers being doubled for the response group service. Also mentioned our introduction of Silk into the Skype for Business client, and finally wrapping up with a discussion and introduction to our call quality dashboard. Hope you enjoyed the session, and thank you for your time.